Hi, this is Todd Nelson, HFMA's Chief Partnership Executive, and I'm thrilled to announce that we are now accepting applications for HFMA's 2024 MAP Award for High Performance and Revenue Cycle. This award recognizes organizations whose innovative and effective strategies have enabled them to achieve excellence in revenue cycle performance. We know your teams are working hard on improving your revenue cycle. They work day and night tirelessly for the patients they serve. Visit hfma.org and check the show notes to learn more.
What the Change Healthcare cyber attack means for the future of the industry. Today on HFMA's Voices in Healthcare Finance podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Erica Grotto. Today we're dedicating our entire episode to the Change Healthcare cyber attack and cybersecurity. I'm interviewing Joshua Corman, founder of I Am the Cavalry, an organization focused on cybersecurity, about what healthcare organizations should be doing as they look to reduce future risk. But first, here's the latest developments on the attack from our news team, Senior Editor Nick Hutt and Policy Director Sean Stack.
Hi, everyone. We are talking about the Change Healthcare outage again. The latest update as of March 19th is that things seem to be progressing as far as getting the claim submission system back up and running. They already got the payment system reconnected as of last Friday, March 15th. And this is all based on the fact that they previously isolated the vulnerability and patched that, allowing them to proceed with the restoration. With the claim submission platform, the necessary software is starting to be deployed to customers, and it seems like they'll be bringing organizations back online in phases throughout this week. We don't know exactly how long it's going to take for everything to get back to what we would consider normal, but there's reason to think, hopefully by the time of our next episode, that things will be at least approaching that point. Sean, from everything you're hearing, and obviously the long-term implications are still playing out, but are we nearing some sort of a culmination of the short-term aspect of this whole episode?
I think so. What we're hearing back from our members, Nick, is that, yeah, the payment system was back up online on Friday. That seems to be like it was pretty much successful. I know our members are reaching out to their provider reps at Change Healthcare this week, trying to work on when they'll hear back from Change Healthcare on when they themselves will be brought back up on the claims piece. I know that's kind of rolling out, like you said, in waves. And that's something that all of our members are following and talking to each other about to give each other updates. And Change has said that that'll take a good week. That'll be rolling out throughout this week. I haven't heard of anyone yet that's back up fully on the claims, but I know folks are working with their provider reps at Change Healthcare to get that rolled out.
Thank you for that information. You pointed out in our last episode that the typical lag between claims and payment transmission means it's probably going to be mid to late March when providers start to really feel the impact of this outage. Of course, the shutdown began February 21st, so we're coming right up on that 30-day turnaround. Might be a little bit longer than that, in some cases maybe 45 days. What are you hearing about that impact and how providers are girding themselves to deal with a potentially substantial reduction in cash flow?
Depending on which payers we're talking about here, and I'm not 100% sure what every state's breakdown is, but, you know, Medicare claims typically pay definitely within 30 days. Traditional Medicare, Medicare Advantage follows more of a managed care claim timeline, minimum usually 30 days to 60 to 90 days. So we're just, yeah, I would agree, Nick. Hospitals are just starting to see, you know, those cash impacts now. Those cash impacts, shortages, or declines will start hitting, I think, this week and next week and really get into pretty dire straits in April for some hospitals that are heavily reliable on the Change Healthcare platforms, either with the payers or themselves. Same thing with Medicaid. I hear Medicaid is still down for a lot of states. The Medicaid interfaces with claims and reimbursement. You know, I think that 6 to 12 months is going to be the cleanup period easily for this system outage. I think hospitals are looking at extensive denials. That's in store for providers on OSS, medical necessity, any of those systems that were down for a while that the hospitals relied on communication with the payer to coordinate care and to coordinate discharges and medical necessity protocols. My biggest fear is duplicate denials, claims being submitted multiple times are going to pepper and really increase denials for hospitals in the hundreds of thousands. And sorting through those will be very debilitating for providers and possibly even account for them missing some of those appeal deadlines on denials and rejections. So I think there's going to be some areas where providers are going to hit serious timely filing penalties based on this outage. So it will be interesting to see what allowances are made there on the payer side and on the Medicare and Medicaid side to resolve some of those denial influxes that hospitals are definitely going to see.
Yeah, all of that is really going to be something to keep an eye on, like you said, as it shakes out over the next year, possibly beyond. Just in the shorter term, things are likewise really kind of daunting for hospitals. We got data from Kodiak Solutions last week, a large revenue cycle solutions company. I think they have solutions in other areas as well, but certainly revenue cycle. They put out a report on March 13th that found a shortfall of $6.3 billion in claim submission from February 21st through March 9th. And they have 1,850 hospitals and 250,000 physicians in their database. So you can multiply that shortfall by some number when you're considering the entire U.S. healthcare system. And again, that was just through March 9th. There's been at least one full week after that when the system was down. Surveys, including those conducted by HFMA in partnership with Eliciting Insights, as well as by the American Hospital Association, indicate a substantial financial impact on providers. The AHA, for example, surveyed 960 hospitals, and 94% of those said they're being impacted financially, with more than half saying the impact is quote unquote significant or serious, and a third saying more than half of their revenue is being disrupted. So it's just, you know, it's great. Everything's going to be back up and running at some point fairly soon, but the fallout, it's going to last a lot longer than that. Sean, anything else that HFMA is keeping its eye on or that you think people should know?
Yeah, that was great. And I think that, you know, not just the reimbursement decline for this period of time, for this almost 30-day period of time, but the excessive, and I do mean excessive administrative cost in IT, in revenue cycle to work things manually, in clinical care pathways to work coordination of care and utilization review and prior authorizations manually for patients. The pharmacy downtime, trying to get pharmacy prescriptions filled for patients, that administrative burden, that uptick in cost are just mind-numbing. And it's very hard to quantify all of that administrative burden that this has caused to hospitals. So it will be interesting to see, you know, what's reported out, how that information is reported out, and how hospitals are made whole through this entire outage.
Yeah, for sure. So plenty to keep an eye on. The breach itself may be passed pretty soon, but the implications are going to last longer than that. Sean, thank you for the perspective on all that. And thanks everyone for listening. We'll certainly be staying on top of the story for you.
We'll be back in a moment.
This is Sean Stack, HFMA's Director of Perspectives and Analysis, and I'm excited to tell you about our new bi-monthly webinar series designed specifically for hospital executives. HFMA will provide timely updates on the latest national healthcare reimbursement and revenue cycle regulations, policies, and trends. This series will equip you with the knowledge and insights you need to navigate the complex world of your healthcare business office. You can register now at hfma.org under webinars.
The February cyber attack on Change Healthcare, a unit of United Health Group, continues to cause concern and frustration for providers. And according to my guest today, such attacks will not be ending anytime soon. Joshua Corman is founder of I Am the Cavalry, an organization focused on cybersecurity, and former chief strategist for the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's COVID-19 Task Force. He explained what the Change attack indicates for the future of cybersecurity and what healthcare organizations should be doing to protect themselves. Why United Healthcare? What made them a good target?
Sometimes these ransom crews target somebody because they're attractive and they think they can extract a pound or more of flesh. Sometimes they're just targets of opportunity where they may have been using a vulnerable piece of software, and they'll do what's called an initial access campaign to successfully get a toehold into lots of organizations. And then subsequently, when they come in and have their coffee, they'll decide who to spring the trap on. In this particular case, whether deliberate or accidental, because so many parts of the healthcare ecosystem depend upon this, this is not like ransoming a single hospital. This affected disruptions to lots of them. They were able to command a very high premium for a ransom payment, given how dependent upon they were.
So let's talk about that very high ransom. Reported $22 million. That has made huge headlines as, I believe, the biggest, correct me if I'm wrong, ransom paid, at least in healthcare. But you have told me if you're focusing on just the money piece, just the ransom piece, you're focusing on the wrong thing. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I don't want to be dismissive of such a large payday, but this is a significantly larger amount than a typical hospital will pay. There's a couple of reasons why I think it's misleading. So before I get to those, some of my hospital friends were really devastated to see this high a payout. They were kind of hoping that after being in the barrel and in the crosshairs of ransom crews for this long, that maybe they would move on to another industry and leave hospitals alone for a bit. But when you see a reward, such a high payout, they're like, oh no, they're not leaving us anytime soon. So whether their hospital is hit or someone the hospital depends upon is hit, it continues to be a lucrative payday. So that very large payout is noteworthy. Where I said it's distracting is a couple ways. One, the ransom itself tends to be a very small part of the total cost to victims, especially when some of these are not easily quantified in terms of dollars or lost record count, but delayed, degraded access to care, worsened patient outcomes, even excess deaths. I think in the story I did with you in the past, we talked about how my team proved statistical loss of life from ransom disruptions that can be associated with excess deaths. So we now know, Congress knows, the White House knows that some of these protracted disruptions in healthcare aren't measured in records or dollars, but rather in patient outcomes and human life. So those are interesting. But I think the real interesting part to this story is we have been fairly cavalier in healthcare, in all the critical infrastructure sectors, but especially healthcare, about concentration of risk, right? When you hear the term merger and acquisition, if you want to drive fiduciary value for your shareholders, you might like it. If you are one of the ones that tends to be on the acquired end of merger and acquisitions, you could say this is predatory. There's been some stories about PE firms squeezing hospitals and the like. But from a resilience, a national security and resilience perspective, there can be significant risk in too many eggs in too few baskets, right? So the more consolidation we have for merger and acquisition, the more concentration of risk we have, where a single point of failure can have very pronounced cascading failures and second and third order effects. So what's really caught the attention of Congress, specifically the Senate, is it's unclear which part of HHS is responsible for the payer middleware part of the market. You know, the FDA does a great job on medical devices. Office of Civil Rights or OCR does a good job trying to find people who have PHI breaches that can be swept up in these ransoms. CMS is looking at minimum cyber hygiene for hospitals to make sure they protect patient safety and patient care. But it's unclear who owned oversight and resilience and security for this part of the market. So Congress is getting very motivated. They're also looking at the fact that as we allow too much M&A, we end up in a Bell and Baby Bell kind of breakup situation like we saw with the phone companies a long time ago. What's good for, you know, individual shareholders may not be good for national citizen stakeholders. And this has certainly raised the concern level, and it's certainly the Senate, on do we have undue, unsound concentration of risk in some areas here? So that's part of the story. And moreover, independent of the mergers and acquisitions, there's a notion in the cybersecurity arena of SICKY, or systemically important critical infrastructure. It's an acronym. And the idea here is, you know, of all the entities in the banking system, there's a handful that if they went down, no banking can transpire. We have similar weak links in the supply chain or concentration of risk in the supply chain for healthcare, for oil and gas, for food supply. The nation's food supply has less than 10 points that if any one of which are disrupted, a lot of people could starve, or you could see at least really some interesting food shortages and or jumps in food prices. So there has been a push to identify these systemically important entities across all 16 critical infrastructure sectors, including and especially healthcare and public health. But lobbyist groups and private sector groups have hated the idea and pushed back really hard. And as such, institutions like HHS have pushed back as well. And CISA, the newest federal agency where I used to work, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, is responsible for taking these in from the various 16 sectors so that we can be better prepared. If we don't know what our systemically important critical infrastructure is, our adversaries will continue to show them to us. That's what's happened here with change. We talk about the boom, right? The bad thing that happens is the explosion. So there's left of boom before harm and right of boom after harm. If we know what the systemically important critical infrastructure is, then left of boom, we can engage them, get emergency contacts, have an action plan that if something happens, this is who we do contact, what we do first, second, third. We can maybe even offer them taxpayer-funded assistance to make it less risky and less likely to go down. So left of boom, there's a lot we could do to do fire drills in case of fire to make sure that these happen less often. And when they do, they're less harmful. And then right of boom, because we've done these things, we can prioritize emergency response, emergency assistance, exercise the plays we did left of boom, maybe have emergency funds that are only available to SICI entities. But if we don't deliberately look for and prioritize these, both left of boom and right of boom, we're going to continue to see elective damage and elective cascading consequences. And the harm to change alone is going to be the cost of this and cleanup. The second order effects on everyone who depends on them is pretty severe. And for some of these small, medium, rural hospitals who have 1 to 4 weeks cash flow on hand, they're not going to survive the recovery. That's why you've seen a number of attempts for zero interest loans or bridge payments to maybe keep them afloat. But we already have financially distressed healthcare, and this just introduced a whopper of a fire. This is like a wildfire. It continues to burn. And unless and until it's put out, we're going to see more and more harm on those dependents.
You just said wildfire. I've done stories on emergency preparedness when it comes to things like weather. You know, mm-hmm. I've talked to people whose hospitals have gone through big hurricanes and such. And that seems to be a pretty important area of focus. Why do you think cybersecurity is not?
I have another nonprofit called cybermedsummit.org, and we do live ER hacking simulations with medical stakeholders, but we also do tabletop crisis simulations. And while we've done several of these in the many years since we launched it in 2017, one of the most fascinating ones had the disaster science team present in the tabletop. They busted out all their playbooks for like a flood, a hurricane, an active shooter situation. And disaster science is really good at this kind of catastrophic event, irrespective of which hazard. So there are times when a pronounced protracted downtime that can affect patient safety, patient life, financial solvency are more like a disaster and a business continuity disaster recovery plan, a BCDRS for your listeners, than it is like a compliance obligation. I think one of the mistakes, if we zoom out, is that healthcare initially determined this was a data breach kind of a topic where it was, you know, PHI information or PCI, you know, credit card data information. And when I started the Congressional Task Force for Healthcare 2016, I said, I love my privacy. I'd like to be alive to enjoy it. You know, we have more incentive to have a corpse with their privacy intact than keep patients alive. And no one disagreed. And so we had an early binding that cyber in healthcare meant confidentiality of records. But what it really means, increasingly proving to be, is it's maintaining access to medical records to enable the delivery of patient care. It's provide medical care so you and your family can get timely access to care when and where they need it instead of multi-month downtime. And third, that we support community health and public health, because if a region has enough overflow resilience to send ambulances across town to absorb a closed hospital, fine. But if we have enough closures or weakened acquisitions and you can't send them somewhere else, if someone can't get heart care in the minutes it needs or stroke care in the hour or so it needs, people die. So I think we have to reset and reprogram that this is not just a confidentiality of records thing, but often includes disaster science, patient safety, human life, and increasing liability. So I think Congress has figured this out. I think the White House has figured this out. The sector itself has not yet internalized that this is a patient safety issue. Some of the sector says those words, but the overwhelming majority of the practices and incentives we have are tuned for something more tolerable, like patient records and fines.
What do you think should be the focus going forward?
Well, I think it depends on who we're speaking about. I think in a lot of ways, we've had lots of wake-up calls for healthcare. We talked about some in the story I did with your magazine. You know, St. Margaret's Hospital closing its doors forever last spring, in part citing its ransomware as a contributing cause of its death. Melanie Evans has done some front page stories in the Wall Street Journal about how acquired hospitals in poorer neighborhoods tend to seriously erode quality of care or access to care. So there's a lot of things that have been like, you know, the wake up call, so to speak. But if we look specifically at this one, I think there's a few different slices. Congress and specifically the Senate is pretty upset about this event for plural reasons. I think they don't see enough accountability and ownership within HHS, and they want to find out how this might have fallen through the cracks. Number two, they're really hot and heavy to bring up this systemically important critical infrastructure project that has not really been started or executed yet, but this might be the flashpoint that makes it so. Number three, with some of the specifics on Change Healthcare, it looks like the DOJ, I'm not as informed on this, but it looks like the DOJ tried to stop this acquisition of Change and was unsuccessful in doing so. So that may get revisited. And if we do have too much concentration or consolidation across the healthcare ecosystem, you know, you may see corrective actions proposed like we did breaking up Mama Bell to the Baby Bells long, long time ago before many of us were born. But what you can do in individual hospitals, while the government's figuring out it's sicky, you could do something yourself. You could scrutinize which of the services and products that you procure and acquire, if they shut down for a day, for a week, for a month, what your tolerance levels are for those. And as you spend your limited dollars on these, you can try to make sure that you have contingency plans and supply chain resilience such that you're not over dependent on maybe some of these larger entities that'll be increasingly targeted. Or you can start to ask for and demand evidence of what your entities that you're giving money to are doing to secure themselves, have service level agreements that if they're down for longer than X, there's contractual penalties and remunerations that can be made. So we are pretty dependent on these undependable things. And in the meantime, that's not going to change. What we can do is be smarter about how many eggs you put into how many fewer baskets and how much accountability we expect from those who put us into these concentration of risk scenarios. So you can consult your security team or your security consultants on the highest levels of dependence and how you can buy down risk or mitigate risk. And one of the best ways to do this is tabletop crisis simulations, where you play games on the table to identify what will fail and how badly before it's happening in the real world, and maybe have contingency plans accordingly. So I wish this planning didn't have to fall to each of you, but unless and until the government catches up on identifying and buying down risk in these systemic risk choke points, you're going to have a bit more of the burden to carry.
Joshua Corman, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Voices in Healthcare Finance is a production of the Healthcare Financial Management Association and written and hosted by me, Erica Grotto. Sound editing is by Linda Chandler. Brad Dennison is the director of content. Our president and CEO is Ann Jordan.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.